Coming up on Triangulation, I'm going to speak with Katarina Fake. She's done so many things, but now she's launching a new podcast called Should This Exist? Fascinating topic. Coming up next on Triangulation.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode 386, recorded Friday, February 22nd, 2019. Should this exist? This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Triangulation. My name is Jason Howell. I'm sitting in the hot seat today, and I love doing this show because I get to talk to some pretty amazing people in the world of technology. And today is no different. Katarina Fake is a partner in YesVC, and we've had you on the show a couple of times. This time we're bringing you on because you are the host of a new podcast that literally just launched like yesterday, just went live for everyone, called Should This Exist? Welcome to the show, Katarina.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's like, you know, a pleasure. Third time.
I know.
Hello, Triangulation.
I think we should probably like dive into the archives and see if there's anyone else that has come on three times, because you could be right at the top of that list.
Maybe. Well, I love you guys. You know, I love your show and, you know, longtime fan. And, you know, I've been, you know, watching Leo's, you know, program since forever.
Yeah.
Forever.
Right on. Well, it is great to get you back. Sorry that Leo couldn't join this time. You were on episode 46. That was back in March of 2012. You were supporting Pinwheel at the time. And then you came on a couple of years later, episode 142, March 2014, in support of Findery, which was basically the app evolution of Pinwheel, right?
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Okay.
We're covering your history here.
Episode 4, what did you call it? 46? That was, you know, that's early.
46, yeah. 2012.
I'm looking down at the bottom of the screen here. This is episode 386.
I know. It just keeps going. That's the thing. So welcome to podcasts, because every single week ticks by and you're on the hook for yet another episode.
I know.
This is just the reality of podcasts.
We're doing seasons. It'll be a 10-episode season.
Smart.
And then we'll take a break, right? Because otherwise, like, my goodness. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, you can really, it can really become a little bit of a hamster wheel where you jump on and every single week you have to kind of keep running on that hamster wheel. So doing it in seasons is a super smart move. Just to catch people up a little bit, obviously, you know, we've got you on because of all the awesome things that you've done. You're an entrepreneur, you're co-founder of Flickr and Hunch, early investor in Kickstarter, Etsy, Blue Bottle Coffee. I'm sure I'm missing a whole bunch of other stuff, but that's just kind of a quick roundup. You are a busy woman.
I'm a busy woman. It's true. I love this new era of podcasting, actually. And I do think, I just did an interview with Natasha Tiku of Wired, mm-hmm. who wrote an article about the return of, she's calling it the artisanal internet. And in some ways, it's very much of the things that I've always cared about. The community, the creativity, the DIY ethos of the very early internet. And has a lot of those wonderful features of, you know, the independent web mm-hmm. that I grew up as part of. And I think that a lot of the things that have been going on recently, there's been a major backlash against Facebook. I mean, even today, there's a Wall Street Journal article about how apps that are not even, Facebook themselves have been gathering your information and sending it to them. So you don't even need to have a Facebook account.
Oh,
that there's a kind of a cultural move back to a lot of these independent media sources. And I do think that podcasting is in many ways part of that.
Well, podcasting, and then there's this kind of reversion now. It's almost like retro web. Now we're going back to newsletters. Seems like newsletters
is this
new fad.
Is that,
it's like, hey, wait a minute, I can get all this stuff in my email. That's fascinating.
I know. Exactly. This is kind of a revelation. But I also think that there's a increased understanding on the part of internet users that it's worth it to choose, to curate, and to pay. right? Mm-hmm. And to pay and not be the product, right? And not have your data harvested and sold. And if you're paying for a newsletter that you really value, and it's $5 a month or whatever it is a exchange that you're much more willing to make now that you understand much better what it is that you're signing up for free services. So,
right.
And I think that's part of what's driving that.
Kind of the trade-off, but also that at this point, it seems like it's been a long time coming, but at this point, people are super comfortable doing that now. Like I remember a time, and it was, you know, quite a long time ago, where the majority of people wouldn't consider actually dropping money for content online because they just weren't comfortable with the idea of even transacting online, let alone, you know, paying for this content or whatever. Now, like you say, I think that's a really good point. People are starting to really be aware, and not just people who are dialed into technology, but by and large. And I think the awareness around Facebook and Cambridge Analytica and all these things coming to a head at the same time are helping just the everyday average internet user kind of understand a little bit deeper, like what that trade-off is, and hey, maybe I don't want to go there.
Right, exactly. So I see this as a fairly positive move. And I also think that this general questioning that's going on about technology and its effect on humanity is also what drove us to building this podcast, Should This Exist?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's kind of all there. It's all there in the title, right?
Should
this exist?
Yeah, you kind of know what you're getting right off the top. And I love this question because it's such a now question. Because all of these technologies that we've seen mature over the years that may have seemed innocent at first, like there's so many, it's a minefield of unintended consequences around mm-hmm. this. And I don't know mm-hmm. how anyone sees this in the beginning, like go back 10, 15 years and take a look at some of these emerging technologies that are very developed now and going into directions that maybe people are feeling uncomfortable with. Why don't they see that in the moment? Why is it so difficult to see?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting because my background is obviously social media, and we made one of the very first, what is now called activity feeds, but we just called it recent activity.
Right.
I don't like the word feed. It sounds like animals at a trough, which may be deliberate, but, we built Flickr as an online community and not as social media. And, you know, the difference there is very profound. A community is something that you have to participate in. It has kind of mores and practices that the community understands and follows rules for conversation. It can be very different, right? It can be a monster truck kind of club, or it can be the, you know, Christian ladies knitting society, right? It could be like of different characters, but community implies the active participation of its members. Whereas social media actually is just your passive consumer, you know, and your attention is being sold. And Facebook was able to do that and sell it to advertisers. And I think that, you know, you asked the question, how would you be able to see these unintended consequences? Well, a lot of that you could actually see along the way. And me and people like, you know, Anil Dash, who was also very active in this, played a big part in trying to raise the flag. I mean, we could see these things happening. We're kind of like old online community people. And we would see things like, you know, the first move was you were sorting the feed by attention, by what got the most attention, right? Mm-hmm. And that in and of itself is a really bad move because that just kind of demotes interpersonal updates or, you know, kind of personal updates about your life and the people that you care about, and promotes things that are, you know, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, spectacular.
Right? The things that are more kind of, you know, spectacular or bloody or like, you know, naked
or,
people.
Or false, right? or outrageously false. Yeah.
Right. And then that was the first red flag that we saw to raise. And then the second was when you could then buy your way there. Oof. Right.
Yeah.
Like you could buy your way into it. And what Facebook was doing, and we all saw this as being kind of deeply wrong, was that they were selling your community back to you. Right. You had to pay to get in front of the community that was already your community and that you had built. And there was something just really, you know, kind of you know, dangerous about this, but you know, everybody knows the Greek myth of Cassandra, right? Where, you know, Cassandra is a prophetess and she is able to see the future and she raises the flag, and, you know, kind of tells everybody, it gives them warnings, but nobody listens to her.
Right. You know, and maybe that's the bigger struggle, right? Is not that there aren't people raising that flag early on and saying, hey, wait a minute, we've thought this through. We've thought forward on this technology. This is where things could head. But it's that the masses choose to not listen or don't take it seriously or whatever. I feel like we're struggling with that right now.
I totally agree. And also I think journalists tend to have moods. There's kind of cultural moods.
Mm-hmm.
And right now the cultural mood is questioning, but the cultural mood previously was celebratory. It was, right. You know, it was, the internet is amazing and look at all this fantastic, like everything's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a celebration. And so it was very hard for those news stories, I think, to break through.
Yeah.
It was, you know, in spite of the fact that we were, you know, kind of out there saying it, mm-hmm. it didn't map to the, you know, Zuckerberg on the cover of Time magazine's kind of mood.
right, exactly. All this is to say that I think your show is perfectly timed because I think this is important. People, you know, critical thinking around kind of where technology is headed, all of these new emerging technologies, maybe they're not even new, like AI is one example. Artificial intelligence is nothing new. Yet in the last couple of years, I feel like we've really seen this like electric fire lit underneath AI, and now it's the savior of the future. It can do everything. It'll solve all of our problems. There are still people ahead of that wave saying, but you know, there need to be rules built around ethics. Yeah. Otherwise, this could go in incredibly, you know, bad directions.
It could go incredibly bad directions, yeah. Right? And I also think that we're early enough in the trajectory of a lot of incredibly powerful technologies, AI, you know, kind of probably foremost among them, but also things like CRISPR,
yeah.
Right? Things like, you know, autonomous vehicles, drones. There's so much going on right now, and these industries are not yet established, yeah. Right? It's the time to ask these questions is now. And there's a growing sense among the users of the technology and the participants in the technology that, you know, they actually have some say in the products that they use and have, you know, what's the much vaunted consumer choice, right?
Sure.
As a result of that, having this should this exist conversation and bringing it to the forefront of people's minds, I think is very important and why we started the show. But I also think, you know, another thing that's going on is that a lot of people have asked me, is this show for entrepreneurs and technologists? And the answer is yes. And it's also for just the general consumer who's concerned about the technology that they're using in their lives and how their technology is taking over their lives and oftentimes their children's lives, especially, which really draws their attention.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really the conversation that we want to be having. And, you know, it's funny because the show is not necessarily answering the question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Should this exist? You know, if I were emperor of the world and I could decide what should and should not exist, that would be kind of amazing. You know, Katarina Fake, ask you, should this exist?
Yes. No.
And I could say, yes, exactly. No. That's really great. But, you know, we're really about asking the question and bringing it into the conversation, raising the issues, right? These are the things that people could conceivably be concerned about,
right,
with your emerging technology. And we found that the entrepreneurs are like tremendously responsive to this in that they love having the conversation. They love having the opportunity to talk through some of these utopian or dystopian scenarios and, you know, doing the thought experiments on, you know, these unintended potential consequences.
Going into a show that pose, you know, whose title is Should This Exist, would possibly make the listener think that you would be answering the question yourself. I kind of, yeah, by listening to episode one, I walked away from it realizing that this is really, the show is about setting the stage around the idea, pulling in people, pulling in experts, people to analyze this particular piece of technology or, you know, whatever it is you choose to do in your upcoming 11 other episodes, but to kind of pose all of those sides, and really the answer comes from the person listening. Do I feel, A, did I even know that this existed? And B, do I now feel like this is a great idea, or what have we done? What have we done opening this Pandora's box?
Yes. Well, we started with Halo Neuroscience, which is a headset not unlike, you know, a headset like this that goes over the top of your head and zaps your brain to make it better for you to learn. You can learn faster. And, you know, as a child, and that was the first episode, which launched yesterday. I'm sure that this was a new technology. A lot of people online were super excited about that. They're like, wow, I didn't even know this did exist.
Yeah,
and so they're kind of running, you know, to try to get a, one of these devices. But there's going to be some really good, surprising new technologies that will be on the show. I'm super excited about. I'm not going to talk about them yet.
Yeah, of
course. But they're really, really good. Like, there's some that are just like, whoa.
Right on. Yeah, you got to keep that stuff close to your chest and you know, release it as it comes. Keep people guessing. I had not heard very much about the Halo headset prior to the episode. And definitely as the episode was playing, I was looking it up. And, you know, personally, like, I'm a musician, like, kind of my passion, creative, you know, side project would be being a musician. And I was looking at that thing and I was like, hey, if that could make me play better. But it also kind of feels... It feels so like so much of a science fiction product, you know, something you might see in a movie, like put on this headset and just do what you're doing and you'll get better faster while wearing it, that it's hard for me to like truly believe. But if it did what it promises, that would be great from a perspective of learning how to, you know, play music better or working out better. But, you know, what are the ramifications of that when you apply it to all other facets of life? For instance, you know, competitive sports. Is it fair for someone to wear this and actually get advanced training versus someone who doesn't?
Yeah. And one of the interesting things that came up in this conversation was, you know, this idea of you know, perpetual improvement, right? And if it's available to some but not all,
right?
And then you end up in this Gattaca type world. And you know, it was a kind of a long conversation that we had about all of that. And then, you know, Baratunde Thurston, who was like our, you know, one of our experts, came up with this, you know, really, you know, dire potential dystopian outcome, which is that who would like this best? Well, bosses, right? And people who have control of other people's bodies. And I was like, whoa. Yeah. You know, when he kind of brought that one up, I was like, wow, that's something else. Anyway, it was such a great conversation, and so many interesting ramifications of this technology came up. And it really is very sci-fi. I mean, the first thing when I saw it, I actually considered that it was very similar to this 1970s science fiction movie that is called Fantastic Planet.
Okay.
It's French. It's so great. And it's literally like you put on a headset pretty much that looks almost exactly like the Halo headset and you learn, right? You kind of, you know, everything that you need to learn. It's like basically going to school.
Right. Information dump.
Is wearing this headset. And it's, you know, it is science fiction.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's, you know, that's a part of the Matrix, right? Doesn't Keanu Reeves learn judo or kung fu or something?
Yeah. So all of a sudden he's, you know,
all of a sudden he's super badass. And I think you also mentioned in the episode, I felt like it was like a fleeting point, but folks on Dancing with the Stars were using Halo.
I love that. No,
I wonder if it actually helped. I mean, and that's the kind of the thing about a technology like this is, you know, how do you know, I guess you can do tests to find, you know, whether placebo compares to this equally or whether there's actually an improvement or whatever, but it's not the kind of thing that as a person using a piece of technology like that, you would immediately be able to say, I know for a fact I learned faster playing guitar when I was wearing it than without, because how do you know that?
Right.
You could have just learned that fast if you weren't playing it and you just had a really good day or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
But...
Should this exist?
Yeah. Obviously people will have to listen to episode one to kind of determine that for themselves. I want to take a break. We have to thank the sponsor of this episode. Welcome to podcasts, because this is how we support ourselves, right? So I'm going to take a break. I'm going to thank the sponsor. And then we'll come back. And I thought we could kind of spend the rest of the show just kind of talking about, like, I feel like the overarching theme of your show is largely based in kind of this idea of ethical considerations, thinking ethically about technology when they are created, thinking of the long-term ramifications on emerging technology. And I thought we could just kind of dive into there a little bit deeper, because now is ripe for the picking as far as that's concerned.
It is.
First of all, I want to thank the sponsor of this episode of Triangulation, that is ZipRecruiter. Hiring used to be hard. It's not always easy. Even in today's job landscape, it's not always easy finding the right people. Multiple job sites, stacks of resumes, a confusing review process, takes a lot of time. But today, hiring can be easy, and you only have to go to one place to get it all done. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards. But that's not all. Like, that's great. That's going to get your job in a lot of different hands, a lot of different eyeballs, but there is more. They have powerful matching technology that scans thousands of resumes that are submitted through ZipRecruiter to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. So as those applications come in, ZipRecruiter does even more work. They're analyzing each one, and they will spotlight the top candidates for you so that you never miss a truly great match. And that's what you're looking for, right? You don't want to spend all day, all week even, focused on hiring for this position. You do, though, want to find the right person for it. So ZipRecruiter is going to cut down the time that it takes for you to do that. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a high-quality candidate through the site within the first day. ZipRecruiter is, it's scanning everywhere. So many people already know about ZipRecruiter. They know that this is the right place to send their resumes, because they know that it works for them too, right? For people who are looking for a position, looking for a job, they know that they're going to be matched appropriately. And at the end of the day, that's what people really want. They want to land in the right place. Right now, Triangulation listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at our exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. You can show your support for this show and ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. One more time, that's ZipRecruiter.com/triangulation. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and we thank them for their support of Triangulation. So, how technology is impacting humanity is really kind of like the theme of this show. And I mean, that's such a broad, powerful kind of statement, because technology is so ingrained in our lives, right? And we probably at this point take it for granted. We don't realize just how impacted our lives are by technology, because we're stuck in the middle of it all the time. So it's an important question. I think people don't have a lot of reason a lot of the times to look outside of it. You know, can't see the forest for the trees, how that saying goes. So are you optimistic about where we are headed as relates to kind of the direction of technology right now? It promises so much, but we also hear, you know, there are a lot of, a lot of downsides that might be on the horizon. What's your take on that?
The age of pessimism. Yeah. Well, you know, I would say that I'm a recovering techno-utopian, but I'm certainly still a techno-optimist. Yeah. I mean, I think, that's my nature. I think that I'm a generally optimistic person as a general rule. And I do think that with, setting things on the right course and with the right kind of attention paid and notice paid and, you know, a constant checking in, that technology can be kept on a positive path and not veer off into dire consequences, which, as we've seen, can have very profound consequences.
Sure.
And I think that, you know, a lot of the things that have happened recently have made us much more alert to this. So I would say it's guarded optimism that I have towards the future of technology.
Do you feel that, we keep hearing the words regulation and, as relates to technology, I feel like technologists, people who are, you know, behind even the largest companies, the largest technology companies, are very used to living by the, you know, move fast, break things. It doesn't matter. Like, we just keep moving, build the audience, and then figure out how to pay for it, you know, how to fund it later. All of these ethos that have come into developing technology to the point that it is now. And by the way, it worked really well. And now suddenly maybe it worked too well, you know, depending on how you look at it. Do you feel that like regulation is the way that we kind of rein this back in, or are technology, are these companies, would they be willing to take control themselves without it?
I think it's unfortunate because, you know, as anybody in the Valley will tell you, working with a great deal of latitude and freedom is very important to the act of invention. And I think it's been one of the strengths of the Valley, right? Is that we haven't been overly regulated, right? And unfortunately, we've kind of, you know, proven that we're not so great at self-regulation. This is not something that we've proven ourselves able to do. And, you know, it's really unfortunate because all of us in the Valley, we know and we trust and we live for that kind of, you know, freedom that we've enjoyed for, you know, so many years. And is that coming to an end? It seems as if, you know, there's increasing moves towards regulation. I mean, Europe is way ahead of us on this. In terms of, you know, regulating kind of privacy and data laws and all of that kind of thing. I think that all of those things are very positive moves and on behalf of the individuals and behalf of the consumers. But, you know, having kind of like oversight. Somebody told me recently that, you know, if you're a Chinese company and you have over 150 employees, a member of the Communist Party joins your company. No. We haven't gotten to that point, but
you're 151 at that point.
You're 151.
Welcome, our 151st employee. We all know who you are.
Right. I mean, but you know, it hasn't happened yet. It, you know, it's happening gradually. I think that, you know, there are certainly, you know, a great many people in the Valley who are lobbying hard to prevent this from, you know, becoming too onerous. Nobody loves a bureaucracy, and bureaucracy is, as we all know, tends to cramp, creativity, I think there's more coming. It's unfortunate, but I think there's more coming.
Yeah. And I think, you know, pointing out GDPR and the effects of that, that's really important in the kind of the depth of this discussion as relates to the U.S. GDPR, even though it's isolated, you know, overseas, has wide reaching effects into the U.S. You know, it's influencing how these companies have to operate to a certain degree. It also opens the eyes of potentially regulators in the U.S. to say, oh, well, that's working over there. Maybe we should do that too. So you better believe it.
And I honestly think that a lot of these are protecting the consumers. They really are. You know, there's a lot of things that are going on with our data that we're not aware of, you know, including the story that came out this morning about your period tracker or your diet app or your healthcare application is feeding all of the information back to Facebook, which people are not aware of. And I think under, you know, European law, you know, GDPR and, you know, other privacy laws, that would just not be possible. And you do notice it when you're in Europe. I mean, you do notice that you're constantly being, cookied. Like you kind of notice because you're forced to whenever in Europe. You know, they send up yet another signal that you're being cookied yet again. And you're like, why does this potatopeeler.com need my, you know, why do they need to cookie me? You know, right? So you start to realize how pervasive it is.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Right? Absolutely. Yeah. And that everybody needs to play by the same rules. Do you think that the biggest companies right now are doing enough to kind of understand the impact of their decisions, the decisions that they make around their technology on humanity? What do you think?
I'm not a big believer in the kind of the big companies being the ones to kind of care for their user information. Yeah. talking about that. I don't see that being the case. But, you know, I'm a startup person, right? I'm a VC, you know, at Yes VC. We are very early stage. We invest in seed stage and even pre-seed startups. I invested in, for example, Kickstarter when it was like a PowerPoint deck. You know, two guys
on the team.
So, I mean, you know, we're willing to go early.
Yeah.
So I'm an early stage investor and an entrepreneur myself. And so I'm very much focused on that stage of the business. And I do believe that you can course correct much more easily, right, than if you're kind of like 10 years in. I mean, trying to turn that ship, good luck. Mm-hmm. But, you know, your business model is all completely wrapped up in this predatory data harvesting thing that you've been doing for a really long time. Right. How are you going to unwind that? And it's much easier to work on different business models, a different admin interface or function, a different, frankly, marketing plan of who are the users that you're going to kind of invite into your CRISPR tool, mm-hmm. or your AI environment, or your, you know, kind of autonomous vehicle. Like, who are you actually selling it to? I mean, that all of those decisions, the business's decisions that you're making very early on in your startup, have a great determining. They're very, you know, you're building the path forward for that right. company and where it's going to go, and anticipating what the possible pitfalls are is super important.
Yeah, well, that was one of the questions that I definitely had here that I wanted to ask you. From your perspective, as a partner, you know, with the SVC venture capital, you've been doing this for a long time. Like, it's easy for someone on the outside to say, "Oh, well, you should have saw this coming." When suddenly a technology veers off course and goes into a different direction. But as you know, someone who's investing money at an early stage in a company, like, how do you analyze and parse those potential ethical, you know, speed bumps? Maybe speed bumps is minimizing it, but because you could decide, hey, this company, this is an amazing idea. I'm willing to put our money into this company and see the development of it. And then over the course of, 5 years or whatever, like, you don't know how the business is going to develop, where suddenly they're doing this thing that from a business sense makes a whole lot of sense. From an ethical sense, maybe not so much. And yet you were there in the very beginning. So there's, mm-hmm. so, you know, do you feel shared responsibility, and how do you try and make that not happen or hope that it doesn't?
Well, I mean, I hope that, you know, when people are coming to Yes VC, as an entrepreneur or a startup that is looking for investment, they understand that, we're different from a lot of the other investors in the Valley. And I think that part of the reason that Yes VC has been, you know, incredibly successful is that we do represent a very kind of human centered orientation towards technology. Mm-hmm. And, there's been a lot of problems with technology, and, you know, a lot of that goes down to governance and who do you have on your board.
Right.
And, you know, everybody's kind of scrambling to, you know, add more women and, you know, add more people who have a more kind of humanistic orientation to their companies. You know, all these people, like, I don't know how, like, suddenly, you know, the chief ethics officers have been appearing, you know,
yes.
on the C-level roster of a lot of these companies. But most of the time you see that as being kind of like a little too little, a little too late. But I think as an investor, and especially as an early stage investor, we make a huge bet. As I said, I bet on, you know, like kind of like companies in, you know, the PowerPoint stage, that you're making a big bet on the character of the founders, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of see who they are and what they stand for, and what kind of people they are. And if push comes to shove, and this is kind of definitely come up in some of the conversations that we've had on Shit That's Exist, as well as in kind of, you know, Yes VC kind of pitch meetings from startups, that there's certain things that an entrepreneur will not do, right? An AI company that refuses to do surveillance, right? Mm-hmm. A social media company that refuses to collect and keep people's data et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, having basically kind of some principles in place. One of my very earlier, like kind of earlier startups that I had was called Hunch. It was later acquired by eBay and eventually shut down. But what it was it was very similar to a lot of companies that are out there, Palantir and, you know, kind of, you know, even Cambridge Analytica. Mm-hmm. But the difference, I think, was that we had done a bunch of things that were very different from those companies, i.e., you always knew what data we had. You always knew what the use of your data was going to be. You could review it. You could delete it. You owned your data, right? It wasn't harvested and kept. And if you read the terms of service of a lot of these companies, they're keeping your data indefinitely, forever, even after you delete your account, which is, you know, to me, kind of just like a really kind of, bad ethics, mm-hmm. and on the part of the company. And, you know, we also did things like, on Hunch, we were trying to do things like undermine confirmation bias in, you know, some of the things that we'd be doing. Hunch was a recommendation engine, and it had to learn about you in order to make recommendations. And so it would gather a lot of information about you that you would deliberately put into the system, right? You knew you were putting into the system, and you knew what you were going to get out from having done that, and you could kind of take away your data at any time. But we deliberately introduced what I was calling a wild card, meaning that it was information that was so let's say you're a Democrat, and we found that if you introduced let's say a book recommendation from somebody from the far, like, you know, Ann Coulter, you'd kind of be kicking it, like, this is not working, right? Like, this machine is not working. But, you know, there's books that are, you know, kind of different political kind of orientations from your normal orientation, or different from your kind of existing taste, and even just like something as trivial as, you know, sweatshirts. And but it would edge you kind of around, and it would kind of label them. This is a wild card. This is something that you don't normally see. But continue to put those things in front of people to try to undermine the natural systems of confirmation bias. Right. And what Eli Pariser calls the filter bubble, right? Mm-hmm. Deliberately making moves in order to not create this world in which you walk around and everybody believes what you do. We know now that this is extremely dangerous for, democracy. Mm-hmm. And yet there are a lot of ways that we built these early systems to carefully address some of these potential problems.
And when you were doing this at such an early stage, I mean, filter bubble as a term, you know, wasn't happening at that point. That wasn't something that was known at that particular point, I don't think. But were you thinking in these terms? Were you thinking in those terms that, like, hey, wait a minute, confirmation, you know, we want to avoid confirmation bias if we can, because it might lead to this?
Well, it leads to, you know, in clothing, it leads to normcore.
Definitely don't want that.
Which we don't want. And, right? Or, but in, you know, in politics, obviously, mm-hmm. I mean, you see the results of that every day all around you.
But, you know, that feels so obvious right now because we're in the middle of it. But, you know, when were you developing this particular product? This was what, 5-7 years ago?
This is 9 years ago.
9 years ago. Okay, yeah, so at that point,
like 2010, 2011.
You know, and at that point, you're creating this technology. If you're doing it with an awareness of trying to avoid what we would now call some sort of like a filter bubble, you know, confirmation bias, that sort of thing, that's a lot of awareness. Like, that's pretty impressive that was, you know, part of the thinking even then.
I mean, I don't know if like how impressive it is. It's just kind of my name. I was the kind of chief product officer. And yeah. So I was in charge of this mm-hmm. at the, you know, kind of at the outset of, you know, developing the product. And so it just, I don't know, it just came naturally.
Yeah.
It just was something that I was just aware of. You just kind of, you know, you have ideas of what you want the product to be, who you want
sure.
it to serve.
Sure.
And you think through all of the consequences of all of your decisions, right? Because, you know, I was for many years, I was on the board of directors of Creative Commons, run by Larry Lessig. And Larry Lessig famously said, and he even wrote a book with this title, Code is Law, right? And I've always believed that if you are the progenitor of a system of software, it inherently takes on your values. It takes on the values of the people that are building it, right? And if one of your values is a kind of a civil society and, you know, kind of a democratic society, and that's very important to you, you will notice those things when you're building the software. And if you have a lot of like life experience, you've been through different relationships, you've had, you know, relationships that have not succeeded, you've had a lot of you've lost your job, like all of these life experiences that people have, you know, there's a kind of a tendency in the Valley to kind of orient itself towards very kind of like young, very male founders, right? Mm-hmm. And we see this over and over again, like 2.5% of venture capital goes into women founded companies. I mean, it's crazy. I bring as a kind of like a mom, right, who's kind of, you know, older than a lot of the people in the Valley these days, a different perspective, and always have. You know, I just come from a very kind of humanities background. You can see, you know, even in the room behind me, it's full of books, right? I'm a big reader. I just pay attention to that kind of stuff. You know, mm-hmm. culture and society, psychology, human psychology, all that stuff is very important to me. And I bring it from this different background that I have. Bring this into technology and bring this into this conversation on should this exist, which, you know, a lot of these people have been excluded.
Sure.
I mean, even like Peter Thiel is kind of, you know, down on college, especially down on the liberal arts. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so this is like tragic to me. You know, it's a tragic development, because without an understanding of the consequences of certain decisions that you're making in the design of your software, you are creating a civilization. You are determining what the laws are, what the practices are, what the rules are inside of those systems. Code is law. And if you don't have a good sense of what equality means and how it manifests itself in society, what is a civil society? How does it work? How are laws made? How are disagreements resolved? If you don't have a good sense of that, what your responsibility is, you know, as a kind of another human being to the kind of the rest of the people that you're building the software for, you know, God help us.
Yeah. So then where is the failure then? If there are, you know, a number of these new company, you know, senior executives, you know, creating these companies, not considering enough, it seems, the ethical considerations of the technology that they're creating, and really just kind of like, my product is the most important thing, everything else be damned. Like, is that a failure on the part of universities? Like, you know, because we know they're getting educated about how to start these companies. Why aren't they getting educated about the ethical components? Or does money just trump all? money is more powerful than
all.
Everything.
Money, I mean, honestly, I have to say money trumps all. I was on the Board of Trustees of the School of Information at Berkeley. And if you go onto the Berkeley campus, you know, there's a couple of rooms that are set aside for the philosophy department or the English department or the psychology department. But then there's this like massive, fancy, huge, marble covered building that's the business school. Right. And that's where all the money is. And that's where all of the people are going. And, you know, I went back to my own college just recently. I went to Vassar College on the East Coast in upstate New York. And, I was there for, of course, it was the sophomore career connections weekend. So it did orient itself towards the more career oriented people there. But I was an English major, and I was shocked at how few English majors there were anymore. Pretty much everybody was an economics major.
Because money's what it's all about. Everybody knows
it's all about money. And
yeah,
you know,
so
I think
money
this is
to be
a,
made.
And look at me, you know, I'm an incredibly successful technologist, an entrepreneur, I was reading an article about this, like, how is it that I've been able to succeed in the 21st century with a 20th century education?
Yeah.
How has that worked? It's crazy. Anyway, yeah, so I do believe I'm a huge believer. I'm a huge believer in the liberal arts and humanities. Huge.
Yeah.
Huge. I think it's so important. And I also think it gives you a superpower in this industry that's underappreciated. You know, anybody can learn how to code, right? Like, I learned how to, you know, I wrote like, you know, basic, geez, when I was, you know, a kid. You know, everything changes so fast that you're just going to have to relearn it all over again. You know, no matter what, you're like, I don't know, Python's going to be, you know, obsolete.
Yep.
I mean, you know.
Yep. It all changes. Soon, you know, computers are just going to be writing its own language. It's going to be creating its own apps. We won't even be involved with it anymore.
That's true, yeah.
Do you think founders, CEOs, inventors actually are being asked about the ethical foundation of the new technologies that they're creating? I mean, I feel like now they're starting to, because the heat is on. Why hasn't that happened in to a greater degree until suddenly things are so hot in the kitchen that people have to?
It's been a runaway train.
Yeah.
You know, it's been a runaway train. It's been, you know, so much so fast and so miraculous. And, you know, it was only, gosh, when was the iPhone released? 2007?
Yeah, that was, yeah, about 2007,
six,
I think.
2006, 2007, and then the iPad came out in, I think, 2008 or 9.
Yep.
Yeah, anyway, but, you know, like, look at how much has happened in, you know, 10 years, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it honestly, there was just, like, people were honestly just trying to keep their hat on.
Right. And make the money while you can.
And
keep doing because the
keep
people
doing
are buying
doing
it up.
Because like everybody loves it, and we're making money hand over fist. And you know, money is a great intoxicant.
Yes, absolutely. And then of course high level executives, that's one thing. Now we're hearing about kind of employee backlash. Employees are pushing back on the technology that their companies are developing. They're getting really involved in being vocal. At least, you know, we're hearing about this at Google and Facebook from the inside out. How much of an impact do you think that places on, especially like a large company like Google? It seems like it's making it's having some sort of an effect, but is that part of the bigger
answer?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you saw the news yesterday. The news yesterday was that Google had actually eliminated their arbitration.
Yes.
Kind of their, like, this very kind of like onerous arbitration that they were requiring of anybody who was bringing any kind of complaint against the company. It was gone.
Yeah.
And honestly, a lot of that was because of that big walkout.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, I think that the employees of the companies are realizing that they're working on things that are not aligned with their own values, and that they actually have a lot of power because they're the people that are actually building the products.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they see that their company is doing something that they feel is, you know, against their own personal values, it's important to have, you know, you go to work every day. You want to be working on something that you believe in,
mm-hmm.
right? It's what you're doing with your life. And, you know, this new kind of empowerment of, you know, employees at tech companies, especially, you know, this will have succeeded when it, you know, has extended to, I don't know, Procter & Gamble or Halliburton. But I think it's actually very, very promising. And you know, part of should this exist is also giving people the language to ask the questions, you know, and having that, you know, exercising that part of the part of your brain, the moral part of your brain, the thoughtful part of your brain in the creation of all of these things, right?
Right.
I have a little poster on my wall that says, you know, before you create things, you should think about them mm-hmm. for a long time, right? That you should, you know, you should make things, and should make things, you know, prototype them rapidly, but you should also kind of sit back and look at them. I was a painter for many years, and I had a painting studio, and you would paint. I was an extremely prolific painter. I painted a lot of paintings, right? Mm-hmm. As an entrepreneur, I also moved very fast. But if you ever came into my studio when I was kind of a semi-working artist, I guess you would say, most of the time I was like this, like kind of...
You were
kind
thinking.
Of staring, like yes. I was like staring Analyzing. At the painting, like yep. so, like you know, honestly, like that's kind of how painting gets done. Mm-hmm. It's like there's a little bit of like kind of like I'm painting, and then you know there's like you know kind of a good 20 minutes of
visioning more than painting, and then there is the act of acting
yeah,
on
like,
that.
I think it's really important, and also things move so fast in your life that you have to just as a kind of a sensible human being. You have to set aside a couple hours to just think,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
have nothing going on,
mm-hmm.
right? In which you can just have your mind free and you're phoneless and yes. interruptionless, it's you know, and all that.
Absolutely.
And if once you've got that, like, you know, it leads to not only human flourishing on your part, but on the things that you build.
Yep. Well, and so you're talking a little bit about like invention, you know, coming up with a great idea, being a founder of a company, being an inventor of a new technology. And as I think about it, I think like inventors, founders, they might always feel strongly that if something doesn't already exist and they are the ones to first create it, that yes, of course it should exist, right? Is that temptation too difficult to overcome when you think of something that doesn't exist and you're like, well, I could be the one to make that happen, but maybe there's an ethical component here that I should pay attention to, but it doesn't exist yet and I've thought of it, let's do it anyways. Like,
right.
is that temptation too difficult to overcome?
Well, I think that's a positive. It's a, you know, this is the kind of, you know, one of the great things about, you know, entrepreneurship and frankly living in a society like ours, which right. which grants us the ability to be able to do this. I don't think that can be under estimated. You know, there's lots of cultures out there, even, you know, kind of very free kind of democratic societies, which are much more you know, frankly, you can't do that, or you know, societally, you know, entrepreneurship not encouraged, you know, it's just mm-hmm. you know, like, you know, why bother? Like, you know, whereas our society is very much about, you know, embracing possibility. So in that sense, I think that's a great thing. I just wish that there was, you know, 25% more like,
yes, 25% more just stopping and thinking. Huh. Right. Let's ponder this.
Should this exist?
Yes. Right? And there you go. I thought that to kind of round this out today, we could do kind of a little lightning round thing. I came up with a few different technologies, movements, scenarios, and realizing that your podcast is not about actually answering the question, should this exist? But I thought I'd pose a few of these things, these kind of emerging kind of ethical question mark sort of things, and see what you have to think about that. You know, tell me, I mean, maybe you have a strong opinion on whether they should exist or not,
okay.
but there's a little ethical tangle happening with some of this stuff. So I'm curious right. to get your take on it. And just, you know, you don't have to spend all day like diving into the depths of this. I thought I'd just rattle off a few and you let me know what you think. So pet cloning. Okay. What do you think about pet cloning? Do you think this is a...
pet cloning.
Yeah.
I think that pet cloning, honestly, is fairly harmless. I know that, for example, Barbara Streisand, who is always getting kind of pegged as, you know, this technological innovator for things like the Streisand effect.
Yes.
She has, like, I think she's had the same dog like 4 times in a row you know, that she's cloned. In general, I think they're, I think it's a bit weird.
It's a little weird.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I think it's kind of you know, there's a weird uncanny valley thing to it, but
yeah.
so long as, I mean, And I certainly think you could spend your money on, yeah. I mean, it must cost a lot of money to clone your pet.
It must, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but, and you never are truly convinced that you actually have a true clone of your.
Right, and like
it's not the same.
It'd be interesting to interview, you know, Barbara Streisand on should this exist and kind of talk about the personalities, like how much of it is nature versus nurture?
Absolutely. Make that happen for season two. I love that. Kind of along a similar vein, designer babies, right? Like the science.
Yeah, this I don't like. No, okay. This I do not like. I think that it's great that if you have, I forget, there's certain kind of genetic, predispositions towards disease. A lot of people have these, you know. Remember, you know, you kind of go for genetic testing before you have your baby, to try to, you know, see what the potential diseases that they could have. And if the case is that you can eliminate some terribly tragic diseases pre-birth, I think that no objection to that. But if you want your baby to be, I don't know, taller, if you want to pick their eye color,
yeah, blonde hair,
you know, like ish, yeah. Like yuck, you know, because yeah. I had a roommate who was Japanese, and she always watched Japanese television. And one of the things that shocked me about it was that there are all of these, she called them round eye commercials, right? And they were about kind of these plastic surgeons had these advertisements about these kind of like sad, unhappy people with almond-shaped eyes who then went into the plastic surgery and got their eyes like round eye surgery. And then they were like off playing tennis and going on dates and driving in sports cars.
Oh, wow.
And I just found this so like racist, like kind of, yeah, like kind of, you know, self-hating. And, you know, I kind of feel that this sense of people as their perfect versions of themselves, mm-hmm, right? Presenting themselves as these, you know, there's a lot of people, like apparently plastic surgeons always get these people like, I want to look like my, you know, my Facebook image, right? I want to look like my Instagram. I want to look like Instagram with this filter on, right? This version of myself. And to do that to someone else, like a kid that hasn't even, like, ugh, yeah, yug, this stuff, no.
Yeah.
Anyway, does that have babies? Should not exist.
All right. Good. deep fake technology. Like, and I'll just say, like, deep fakes, kind of the technology behind deep fake both fascinates me and frightens me to no end. So that's why I put that in here. What do you think about kind of the direction of deep fake? Should it exist?
Yeah. I mean, I do. Like, I'm one of these people who believes that AI should come with like a little, you know. You know how gas, which can kill you, has no scent?
Yes.
And if you get a gas leak in your house, they actually put some stinky stuff in it so you can smell that there's a gas leak.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of feel like the same thing should happen with AI, right? There should be like a little high-pitched buzz. That there's, you know, this is not, you're not actually talking to a real person. This is AI.
This is
right?
Not real.
And,
yeah.
Right. So yeah. I'm one of these people. I believe this I kind of have this belief that, you know, I'm not of these, you know, Turing people where it doesn't matter if it's a person or a machine. I'm more of the Ada Lovelace school of thought where it actually matters. There's a difference between humans and machines, and we should actually try to, surface that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for deep fakes, you know, I think it's also fascinating. Right. And it's also kind of, you know, cool. And you can make, you know, Obama spew out, you know, kind of messages of hate. You know, that's not so great. But, you know, they should have something to identify the fact that this is what's going on. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of feel like you shouldn't, you know, try to like, you can try to fool yourself in the like, I enjoy going to horror movies to be scared kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess mm-hmm. that's a form of entertainment, but, you know, if you're actually trying to deceive somebody, like, no, obviously no.
Yeah. Yeah.
Use case is kind of like, you know, dependent on use case.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Familiar with Sidewalk Labs? That's the Google thing that's going on in the Toronto streets, tracking people, technology that tracks basically everybody, every citizen's kind of like movement and actions out on the street, and analyzing them obviously with AI in the back,
right.
The background. What do you think about Sidewalk Labs? Is what they're doing too creepy to exist, or what do you think?
It's creepy. It's definitely creepy. I mean, you know, there's a lot of science fiction novels, including 1984, that have been written about this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And one of the most important things is that you have, you know, freedom of movement in life. I think this is a very important thing, that you have privacy in life, that you are, you know, a citizen that is not, you know, like surveilled perpetually, right? I mean, we do live in, you know, kind of a world in which I forget what the statistic is, but it's something like, you know, you're photographed like 20 times a day without your knowledge.
Oh, wow.
You know, just with kind of, you know, small, if you live in an urban area.
Mm-hmm.
And
probably more than that. Yeah.
Probably more than, I don't know, like, is your bank machine looking at you when you go to the ATM?
Yeah. I mean, if you're just passing along on the sidewalk, you probably got picked up by a few cameras.
Yeah, you're picked up by a few security cameras.
Yep.
And, you know, that's one thing, right? But if it's kind of this massive, global, data-gathering organization called Google, I mean, yikes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I would be wearing my, not my tinfoil hat, but my tinfoil suit.
Driving in your tinfoil car everywhere that you
Driving
go.
Driving my tinfoil car, you know, with my, you know, El Chapo plastic surgery to make me look like a, like, no, like, you just kind of like want to be, you know, just an ordinary citizen walking down the street unsurveilled.
Absolutely. Katerina, this was a lot of fun. I'm super stoked that I got the chance to do this interview with you. Katerina Fake, of course, the host of Should This Exist, the new podcast launched yesterday. People can go to shouldthisexist.com to find the episode on the web. Of course, it's also in Apple Podcasts. I have Pocket Casts on my Android phone, and it's there. Everywhere you can find podcasts, right?
Yeah. It's everywhere.
Right on. And I love the first episode, by the way. I think it's really well produced. Like, I love that's kind of a trend right now in podcasts, is that, you know, like you said, anyone could do a podcast, but these things, like these shows now are being produced so well, from audio to sound effects to music. I mean, it's, you know, it's a whole storytelling environment, and you guys do a really good job with episode one. So I'm really looking forward to listening to more, Katerina. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure talking with you, Katerina.
Likewise.
We'll talk with you soon.
Take care.
We do the show every Friday. Usually we do the show at 11:30 a.m. Pacific. We did a little bit earlier today, but if you're subscribed to the show, that doesn't matter to you. You're going to get it in your podcast feed a little bit later on this afternoon. So every Friday, a new episode of Triangulation. Go to twit.tv/TRI for Triangulation. There you're going to find all of our episodes, all 385 of them. Actually, this is 386. So you've got a little catching up to do if you haven't already listened to them all. They're all there. And then twit.tv/live. If you want to watch us live, we do this show live. Like I said, every Friday starting at 11:30 a.m. Pacific, so you can join in on the chat room. Patrick Delahanny here at Twit did put an update into the chat room to say Katerina, Cory Doctorow, Daniel Suarez, and Kevin Kelly are all members of the Triangulation Triple Timers Club.
Wow,
so
awesome.
you have good company, Katerina.
That's great.
Thank you, everyone, for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Triangulation. Bye, everybody.